Hello, welcome and thank you for joining us and listening to our podcast, The God Beyond the Bible. Our podcast is released weekly each Friday. The content of each episode is based on the questions and curiosities we all have about God and the Bible. Many of our topics are considered taboo in the minds of the mainstream church. You will find our discussions to be, I think, refreshing and often far from traditional. But we don't just skirt around these complex issues, but confront them head on, and not in the way you're used to hearing them discussed on typical Christian talk shows. I'm Alan Rowland, creator and host of The God Beyond the Bible. As of the launch of this podcast, I've been a pastor for more than 35 years. My co-host is my daughter, Trayson, and our engineer, co-producer is my daughter, Tabitha. Our mission is to encourage our audience, along with us, to open our minds to the reality that God is simply too big to be fully explored or experienced by the reading and studying of a single ancient work. In short, the Bible's not the sum of God, and to think this is to limit what He has done, is doing, and what He will do in our future. So with introductions made, thank you for listening, and let's dive into the topic of the day.
Okay, welcome seekers to podcast number 58 of God Beyond the Bible, a podcast made by seekers and for seekers. We launched our podcast in January of 2019, releasing 52 episodes last year. And as those of you who regularly follow the podcast already know, we replayed five of our most listened to episodes from last year to fill in for January of this year, while we took a little time to catch up on some personal tasks that we needed to do. This episode, number 58, is the sixth new release this year to date, and we just wanted to throw that out there for the benefit of our new listeners who may have just stumbled upon those replays. Speaking of listeners, we have any shout-outs this week?
Yeah, our shout-outs this week are to Gary B., Podraic, Kendall, Kyle, Dustin, and Vizlet.
Thanks, guys.
I'm glad you said that. Okay, and our quote of the week, and I thought this was pretty cool. Never waste any amount of time doing anything important when there's a sunset outside that you should be under.
I like that.
But we can't hardly follow that, can we? But it's, I've got something important to do, and that's not important.
Go ahead.
Well, last week was episode 57, of course, and it was an episode titled Politics, America's New Religion, a title that's pretty much self-explanatory. If we were to make one added remark pertaining to that episode, it would be to encourage those who are seeking peace and calm in their spirit, just take a week or even a day, and don't expose yourself to or think about or discuss any political or social issue, and see if it isn't one of the best days you've had in a long time. Walking away from all the political controversies, much like breaking a bad habit. And let me warn you, it's easy to gravitate back toward those old ways.
Yep. So in this episode, we're going to talk about a very important topic that I'm surprised it's taken us this long to get around to. And I guess we could title this episode, The Silent Period.
So let's go ahead and jump right into this episode with an explanation of what The Silent Period is. For those of us who haven't given a lot of thought done much research on the topic, the silent period is some 400-year period between the time of the last book of the Old Testament, Malachi, and the first book of the New Testament, Matthew. And if you do the schoolwork that Tabby should have done when she was in school, it was called the intertestamental period.
Right, right. It's just easier to say that silent period.
It definitely is.
At first, one may ask, as we did, why? Why is that period important? If there were any important events that transpired during that period, wouldn't it be in the Bible? This very question, and the important answer to that question, is what this podcast is all about. When you hear us use the phrase, the Bible's not the sum of God, this topic today clearly validates that statement and claim.
Have you ever been curious why that 400-year period of Jewish history was just left out? Wouldn't the Bible itself have had a better flow from the Old to New Testament if we had at least one more book to span that 400 years? You know, sort of like a time bridge connecting the two very different periods?
And I don't think a lot of people ever think about that.
I don't think so. You kind of see it as just there were these two periods of time. And almost in your mind, you picture them as kind of a cut.
That's the wind outside.
If y'all hear any noises, it is raining a little bit here, and there might be some thunder.
It's March. You're getting March wind. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, sis.
But you kind of picture it as a cut scene in a movie where it just goes black for a second and then it starts with the birth of Jesus.
Yeah, and we talk about there was 400 years between the prophets Malachi and John the Baptist. You hear that said, but nobody talks anything about it. It's just like, okay, God didn't do anything.
Right.
Wasn't anything going on.
He just went on vacation for a few years.
And time stood still.
So, as we will talk about, there was a lot of really important stuff that happened to the nation of Israel in that 400-year period of time. And believe it or not, a mass of secular history has documented that period. And even more amazing, there were two books that were part of the collection of books that we call the Bible that were written detailing that very period of Jewish history that were rejected as canon. They are the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees.
We'll talk more about those two lost or rejected books later in the episode, but since we seem to often find ourselves pointing out some negative impact the Catholic Church has had on our Bible, we are glad to say today that it was the Catholic Church, not the Jews or even the authorized King James translators, who obviously saw the value and benefit of these two books, speaking of the Maccabees, of course, and preserved and even included them in their Catholic Bible. I didn't know that. I've got to say to my Catholic friends, I didn't know that.
And I have to say, too, that we don't have a problem with anyone who's of the Catholic faith.
No, it's the organization
and the powers that be.
And it's not just that. It's just history. We're just talking about the real stuff that happened. And look, hey, the Protestant church has had plenty of negative influence. We've done plenty of stuff that is impacting right now. We've had the reins here in America for last 500 years or so, especially in America, the last 250 years of American, last 100 or so years, we've really had
the
reins.
We've made our own footprint.
And we've left our fingerprint.
Okay, now it's important to point out how much the world had changed, especially the land of Judah, between the recording of Malachi and Matthew. Malachi closes out the Old Testament with Judah under the rule of the Persian Empire, and when we turn the page to the New Testament, Jerusalem and the whole land of Judah are suddenly under the Roman Empire.
So to try and keep this from sounding like a history class, especially for Tabby because she's not a big history fan, we will only hit a few of the historical highlights, and with the least amount of research on the individual's part, there is plenty of historical documentation available, including the aforementioned books of the Maccabees.
Yeah, and you can get all that on YouTube. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, you can just
if you don't want to read it, you can watch it.
Just put silent period in the YouTube, and it'll be tons. There's lots of it, yeah. And even the books of Maccabees can be read. They're audio on YouTube. Is it me on number 8?
It is.
Okay. The Old Testament goes silent with the book of Malachi, which leaves off with Jerusalem and the whole land of Judah under the rule of the Persian Empire. Now, what is really amazing about this 400-plus year period is that the entire book of Daniel's prophecy, and I never realized this, I've got to say, all these years, the entire book of Daniel's prophecy is played out step by step in minute detail during this period. Many, if not all of the things that people are using out of the book of Daniel to predict some still future event were actually very clearly fulfilled in the silent period.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. Some are under the false impression that the reason the Jewish writers remained silent during this period was because there was no temple, and they believe that since there was no temple, God was not speaking or working in the land of Judah and the nation of Israel. The truth is, there was a temple during this entire period. It was the one rebuilt during Ezra and Nehemiah's time, and it was the same temple that Jesus stood in and taught and was destroyed in 70 AD.
And I thought it was interesting when I was doing my reading and research that outside of the silent period, the temple only stood for about 120 years on either side. It was about 100 years before the silent period started, and then
in the
500s,
it was about 539, I think, BC that the temple was built. So that's 539 years, and then it just lasted to 70.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I never even thought of that. That 400, you take that 400 years out of there, and the temple didn't do much, did it?
No, it didn't.
Didn't stand for very long. Wow. Well, I guess with that thought, we'll pause, return with part 2 of episode 58 of God Beyond the Bible.
Welcome back, listeners. Today's episode topic is the silent period, and we're talking about that roughly 400-year period between the book of Malachi, which ends our Western Old Testament Bible, and the book of Matthew, which begins our New Testament.
And as we pointed out in segment one, there's a mountain of historical events that transpired in that period that is recorded in secular history and biblical history alike. That is, the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees that we mentioned in the first segment, that thanks in no small part to our Catholic friends, is still very much available for our research today. In fact, had these books been chosen as a part of our canonical Bible, it would have very much boosted the credibility of the Bible itself, since the events that are recorded in Daniel and the Maccabees and secular history interlocked and fit together so perfectly to paint the whole picture from both sides.
And that was one of the times in history that everything came together.
Mm-hmm. And this we is went, what no, blew my mind. That.
Yeah, that everything came together. Prophecy, the historical writings of the day, and the Daniel's prophecy, and then secular history itself all came together at that period of time, and everybody just looked the other way and said, "We don't need any of that."
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand it. Okay. I don't understand it. Am I too?
You are.
Okay, we must move quickly. Malachi ends with the land of Judah under Persian rule. The Persian Empire fell to Alexander the Great. Anybody ever heard of him?
Which
established the, and I'm going to call it, is really the Hellenistic Empire. Grecian Empire is what I've got right now, for a short period of time. Under Alexander's short reign, the Jews enjoyed great liberty and prosperity, mainly due to the fact that as Alexander, and this may be recorded in the Maccabees too, mainly due to the fact that as Alexander was approaching Judah to attack and destroy it, a single priest dressed in white went out to meet the approaching army with a copy of the book of Daniel and showed Alexander the prediction in the book of the one who would conquer the Persian Empire. According to history, even Alexander could see that the prophecy was pointing to himself as victor, and this very act caused Alexander to show the Jews much favor. When the empire was his, Alexander allowed the Jews in the land of Judah almost complete autonomy. In other words, they pretty much governed themselves, and they worshipped as they pleased. Alexander was recorded to have even suspended the empire's taxation on the land of Judah when it would observe their Sabbath years and would allow the land to rest.
Huh.
Now, I thought that was pretty cool, and I thought, and I do think, I'm going to have to look and see if that's in the Maccabees. I believe that's recorded in the Maccabees where the priest goes out.
It very well may be. I haven't read it.
But it is in history. And remember, recently, this is a period of time. This is a period of time when knowledge is being increased. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, schools yeah. are being. I mean, this is the Greeks. These are people that are in. And so history's being kept probably better than it's ever been kept.
Well, unfortunately, this period of prosperity under the rule of Alexander's Hellenistic or Grecian Empire did not last long. However, Alexander's goal to unite the entire empire under a single culture and language did take hold. The language chosen was the Greek language, and the Greek culture, known historically as Hellenism or the Hellenistic society, and its ability to unite the empire under one language and culture was a stroke of genius that still affects us today. It was during that period that the Hebrew Old Testament was translated to Greek, and when you hear anyone referring to the Septuagint, it is speaking of the product of this translation. Even many of the Jews embraced the new language, evident in our New Testament, you know, having been written in Greek instead of Hebrew.
Yeah, because it was written by a bunch of Hebrew guys,
right,
and they
yeah.
were speaking Greek. I mean, just 400 years later, they're all speaking Greek.
Which I actually have some about in the next segment, but it led to a cleansing of Jewish culture. I think the kids learned some of it in their Jewish class. Alexander's empire fell into peril when he decided, without having...
When he died, honey.
When he died.
You guys...
He may have decided to die, but I don't think
have.
He did. Okay.
Let's start
that again.
I had a moment. Let's start that again. Let's just start that whole sentence again. Sorry about that, guys. Alexander's empire fell into peril when he died without having any heirs to succeed him as king. Upon his deathbed, when his army generals surrounded him and asked him who should rule the empire upon his death, Alexander whispered, "The strongest." So again, just as the prophet Daniel predicted, Alexander's generals went to war with each other in a power grab for the empire, thus fragmenting the entire empire that he had worked so hard to unite.
And let me just point out, Alexander the Great started his siege of that empire, the Persian Empire, when he was 20 years old. He died when he was 33. That's how quickly he took that whole empire away from the Persians. It shows you that it was there was something supernatural there for him to be able to do that, but he didn't hang on to it, of course. And he made no, I guess he's like a lot of people, he didn't think he'd ever die. He just thought, now I've conquered. But they said he actually wept when he conquered the last of it because there wasn't anything left to conquer.
And that was what he wanted was to conquer.
He said he was depressed and wept.
Yeah.
Because that's his history. Now, although there were four, just as Daniel predicted, we're only going to concern ourselves with the two of the main players in our saga. The land of Judah was a small piece of land that joined the two main land masses, now controlled by two opposing kings, who were former generals or chiefs in Alexander's reign. They were the king to the north, as Daniel called him, and he controlled, I understand, the territory to the north and east of Judah. And then there was Daniel's king of the south, who occupied the land, I take it that's of Egypt and Judah, bordering Judah to the south and west. Now keep in mind that the land of Judah was caught directly between these two battling factions, and the narrow Judean territory was the only land crossing. It had to be crossed for either king to have access to the other's territory. So Judah found itself being ruled by one and then the other of the two kings. In fact, it's reckoned that they may have passed back and forth several times between the two kings.
Wow. Just as Daniel predicted, while under the jurisdiction of one of the kings, the land of Judah, which included, of course, Jerusalem and the temple, continued to enjoy a certain amount of religious freedom, but fell under heavy taxation.
Because war is expensive.
Right?
And remember, they're crossing right across there. So what do you think a marching army is going to do as it marks through your county?
Exactly.
As it marks through your town. What do you think in your village, what do you think it's going to do? They're going to pick up everything.
Yeah,
and then and they were going to extract as many taxes to support that movement and food and everything else as they can. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
When the opposing king gained control of Judah, he made Antiochus Epiphanes,
Did I say that right?
The ruler of the region, and he had no regard for the Jews or their religion. Now keep in mind that both these kings were former followers of Alexander the Great, and both adopted the concept of Hellenistic society, one culture and language, all Greek.
And even though Antiochus Epiphanes was not a king, he was an appointment to that to the territory of Judah. I wanted to make that because it sounds like I'm calling him a king. But he was a ruler, he was a governor, if you will, of that territory.
So here's a page from history concerning Judah, Jerusalem, and the temple under the new ruler Antiochus Epiphanes. In 170 BC, Antiochus ransacked the temple of Jerusalem, desecrating the sacred precinct in many ways. His belligerence continued, and in 167 BC, he ordered an intensified Hellenization project that denied religious freedom to the Jews. They were forbidden to keep their laws, observe the Sabbath, offer sacrifices, or observe their holy days or festivals. They were forbidden to practice circumcision of their male children, and copies of the Torah were destroyed. Furthermore, Antiochus set up pagan altars in the temple, and the Jews were ordered to offer unclean sacrifices and to eat pork and other forbidden foods.
Now, this is a biggie. According to both secular and Maccabean accounts, Antiochus fulfilled Daniel's abomination of desolation when he set up idols of Zeus in the temple, the god he claimed to be an incarnation of, and he defiled and desecrated the temple by forcing a pig to be slain on the altar of the Holy of Holies and its blood sprinkled on all the articles of the temple to honor himself, or the statue of Zeus, whom he claimed he was.
Right.
So, I mean, is that not pretty clear?
Yeah,
I would say that it is.
That he claiming himself to be God, set himself up in the, you know, okay.
This act infuriated an old Jewish man named
Maccabeus.
Or Maccabees, who, with the aid of his five sons, the eldest being Judas Maccabees.
And let me stop you right there. Uh-huh. I'm not sure it was his oldest. I assumed that, but it was one of his five sons. So I don't want somebody to write and say, hey, you got that wrong, because I may have.
Okay, so one of his five sons,
Judas,
being named Judas, led a revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes, which lasted for 24 years. But ended in a victory and independence for Jerusalem and the land of Judah. Judas Maccabees' name literally means the hammer.
I thought that was God. I just went straight to wrestling or yeah, something right yes. here. But anyway, that's what he meant.
Right. His small army emerged victorious, even when at times he was outnumbered as much as 20-1. And he is preserved in the Maccabees as a great patriot and military deliverer of the Jews, who, by the way, as odd as it seems, did not seem to care if this piece of history was preserved at all for posterity.
Yeah.
Which is strange, because you would think this would be something a they would be deal. Very...
Yeah. He would should have been like a patriarch.
Yeah. Yes.
He should have been, you know, that blows my mind, but I still don't, and I'm sure I don't understand all I need to understand about that period.
Well, due to time restraints, let's suffice it to say that this independence was short-lived, because some historians believe the reason behind much of the Maccabean success was the fact that Rome was also marching against the armies of Syria, the empire of Antiochus Epiphanes, which had them defending themselves on multiple fronts. Rome soon claimed the Alexandrian Empire for itself, and much like Alexander, allowed the Jews and the land of Judah to enjoy a certain level of autonomy, but again, under heavy taxation. Pertaining to the book of Matthew, to indicate how recent the acquiring of the empire by Rome was, I said that completely wrong again, okay. But y'all get the idea. To indicate how recent Rome acquired the empire, it was for tax calculation purposes that Joseph and Mary were traveling to participate in a census to get an accurate idea of how many people occupied the land of Judah.
And you know, wouldn't it have been nice to know that?
Yes. Yeah.
Wouldn't it have been nice to that to be? Well, with that brief historical summary, we'll pause and return with our third and final segment of episode 58 of God Beyond the Bible.
Welcome back, Seekers, to God Beyond the Bible, episode number 58. This is our third and final segment on a topic that we have titled The Silent Period, referring to the 400 or so year period of history between the Old and New Testament of our modern Bible.
We used the first two segments to give a really brief historical account of this period of time, pertaining to which there have been volumes written, both in the secular and the religious sector of history. So let's use this final segment to just process and digest a little bit of this information and talk about if and how it has any impact on us today as believers.
Well, one of the main points that one must ponder and needs to be addressed is how this period of history is a clear and definite fulfillment of the prophetic book of Daniel. Yet, perhaps many or most Bible students don't know anything about these prophetic fulfillments. And do you think it'd have been nice to have something in the Bible to refer to and kind of bridge that gap?
So do you think they did it on purpose? I mean, I know it's pure speculation, but was it so that we would keep thinking that there was still prophecy to be fulfilled? Or do you think they didn't realize that the prophecy was fulfilled?
Fear is profitable. I mean, if you look at it from that direction.
But I'm not sure if that was the motive. It's like Tabitha said, it'll be speculation, but I'm thinking that it was a chaotic time, and even though they had the Maccabees, I watched some stuff on this, and his reason that he thinks they may have chosen not to put the Maccabees in canon,
mm-hmm.
preserve it as canon, he said, and I know as odd as it's going, he said, I think it was just too violent.
Too violent.
Okay. Well, I mean,
I'm thinking of some of the other events that went on in it. It was just too violent, and we did. And he said something like, and I can't quote him, so I don't know exactly who he was, but and he said something like, and the Jews didn't think that was the light they wanted to be.
I see.
I'm just saying that's what he said.
Well, I guess the main point is that even though that period of time has been titled by our modern scholars and theologians as the silent period, it was anything but a period of silence, and this is in no small part due to Alexander the Great and those who succeeded him in their Hellenistic influence on the empire. In other words, they were people who promoted writing and education, including recording history for posterity. They built libraries and collected books from all over the empire and surrounding areas to fill those libraries. In fact, it was this movement that brought about the Septuagint, which is a Greek word that means 70, because of the 70 translators that translated the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. Some say it was for this reason the Maccabees were rejected by later Jews because they were in Greek.
Yeah.
And that, I know that we mentioned it in one of our previous episodes.
In about 150 AD, a group of rabbis got together to decide again what was going to be canon and what wasn't, and they rejected. Remember, it was written in Greek, so when the temple was destroyed, there was both Greek and Hebrew there, and they only preserved what was Hebrew.
Yeah, they called it a cleansing, the Hellenistic cleansing, and they went through and cleansed all of it.
And let me go ahead and say, it wasn't because they cared anything about the Hebrew. They did any writings that they came across, all that went into the libraries had to be in Greek. So it didn't matter what language it was in. They preserved lots of, and it didn't matter what the subject topic was. It didn't matter what it was about. If it was a book, it was confiscated. It was translated into Greek, and then the book would be given back to its original possessors. I mean, think about it. It wasn't an age where a printing press, if there was a book, it was a major thing. And so they didn't really care. All they were trying to do is gather information. They weren't trying to, they didn't really care what any of the books were even about. So that's how we got the Septuagint. And you'll see a lot of people refer back to that Septuagint because it was very well translated.
And it's this promotion of Greek culture that encouraged people from all walks of life to write it down and preserve it. It's from this period that we have some of our greatest historical, poetic, scientific, and philosophical? philosophical, guys, I'm having a day today. I'm so sorry. And philosophical works of all time. And perhaps this is the reason.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Tabby. And perhaps this is the reason the Jews, who for obvious reasons resisted change, would naturally despise this period of great progress and human development. I mean, let's face it. The Jews were all about preserving their own unique national religion and tradition. It was this unwillingness to consider anything new or non-traditional that would place them at odds with Jesus, who came to end the Old Covenant and replace it with a new covenant designed for all the races of people on the whole earth.
Well, let's consider a point we made about Antiochus and Epiphanes. In fact, I read where that the Jews actually changed his life. Epiphanes, we're going to talk about what that means in a minute, but I'll just say it. Let's consider a point we made about Antiochus Epiphanes fulfilling Daniel's abomination of desolation. For starters, we might point out that his name literally means God manifest. That's what his name was, God manifest. They changed his name to Epimenes.
Really?
Which means, I want to think it was something like the madman.
Oh.
So
that's a big difference. That's what the Jews
would purposefully write his name wrong. And it would be like Epimenes or something like that, or Ememenes or something like that. So he would be the madman. Anyway, okay. Let's talk about the abomination of desolation for starters. His name meant God manifest. Mm-hmm. And as we mentioned earlier, he believed himself to be the incarnation of the Greek god Zeus. Since no one knew what Zeus looked like, Epiphanes had statues sculptured in his own image, but he called them Zeus. So the image he had placed in the temple in order to be sacrificed was both his own image and Zeus at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Wow.
Now, Sigmund Freud would have had a heyday.
Yeah, but does that not start explaining some things about this image that was going to be...
Yes.
This is, very interesting. Now, the problem we have with this being the fulfillment of the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet is that Jesus also spoke of the same event or identical event as to take place in a near future event of his own period. In Matthew 24, when Jesus told the disciples that the temple would be destroyed, not one stone left upon another, they asked him for details, to which part of the prophecy included these words, and it's found in Matthew 24:15. The King James Version says, "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand." And verse 16 says, "Then let them which are in Judea flee into the mountain."
So now let's try to sort this out. Daniel's prophecy of the temple being defiled and desecrated was clearly fulfilled and documented during the Silent or Maccabean period, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. However, Jesus seems to reinstate this prophecy to reoccur, this time with the temple not only being defiled and desecrated, but this time completely destroyed. As history tells us, it most certainly was defiled by Nero and his successor Titus and other governors of that period. But this time it was totally destroyed, just as Jesus predicted, and so did Paul in 2 Thessalonians when he referred to the desecrator as the man of sin.
So there's a little kink in that. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody says, well, then it didn't get fulfilled because Jesus said, but Jesus didn't say. I mean, a prophecy could be fulfilled more than once. And in Jesus' prophecy, remember, it was that the temple was utterly destroyed. Mm-hmm. That was the point of his prophecy. Okay. Now, all that is subject to be addressed in a future episode, but sticking to our topic today, our answer, of course, will be purely speculation, but why do you think this period has remained so silent, at least to the knowledge of the modern believer?
Well, I mean, I think one thing is I wonder how many people actually realize that there was that much time that elapsed, modern-day believers, that because we don't talk about it.
Oh, you'll hear a teacher or a pastor, or say, now that 400 years of silence between Malachi and John the Baptist, that's what they're talking about.
But it's always like nothing.
Or that 400 years that Israel had no prophet. But now remember, did you know that back in the book of Judges, they went a long period there with no king and nobody was really just the judges there. But anyway.
But it's almost like in your mind, at least for me, it's like time sort of froze for that 400 years in your mind between the end of Malachi and Matthew. It's like, you know, people were born and people died, but there was nothing really going on.
And yet, it's considered...
It was this explosive time period.
It was considered the period of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and who has ever known 400 years on the earth to just be completely mundane with nothing happening?
No, this is true.
So do you think it would be profitable for the church to present this information that fills in the gap between the Testament periods?
Well, of course it would. I mean, look at us today as we're just going through this, been in church, been in the, and nobody's really, you know, we just, whatever the Bible says, it's just, we can't go outside that parameter. We have to set that parameter and we can't go anywhere outside that parameter because it would be just speculation then.
That's true.
It is.
I think that's the attitude. I'm not saying it would be. I'm just saying that's our attitude. It would just be speculation because if it had been important, it'd have been in the Bible.
Yes.
And so, I see a bunch of important stuff that happened.
Well, and people who have that mindset, a lot of times they don't think that you can parallel the Bible with secular history. You know, it's like these are two totally different.
Because the Bible is...
When really they're very much intertwined.
But you know what's amazing to me? I've got to say to our scientific community or our historical community, they don't mind at all to use the Bible to reference something that to for a historical fact.
Right.
But yet we have this idea that we can't use anything they wrote. We can't trust anything they wrote down. That's not trustworthy.
So one more very important but little known or talked about fact. When Judas Maccabee won the independence for the Jews, they went in and fully cleansed the temple, even removing the stones of the altar that had been stained with pig's blood and replacing them with new stones. And upon the victory that led to the reopening of the temple and the temple worship being reinstated, the Jews implemented a celebration to mark and honor the event. It was implemented to be held annually in what is in our modern Gregorian calendar, the month of December, and it's an 8-day festival that's called the Festival of Lights or Hanukkah.
Now, do you find it odd that they still celebrate the event, yet don't use the Book of Maccabees that actually documents the implementation of the holiday or the celebration?
That is very strange.
I do.
Yeah. I don't understand.
I never knew that. I never knew what Hanukkah was based on. I never really knew.
When I was helping Tabby put together a study for her kids on Judaism, Hanukkah was one of the festivals and holidays that comes up. And they tell you that it's in celebration of the revolt of Judas Maccabees.
Uh-huh.
But that's it. I couldn't find, and I got it from one of the Jewish websites, but there was very little information because about when just, or what. It was just, this is who we're celebrating.
Yeah, the cleansing of the temple. This is how we celebrate. And let me go ahead and say, I didn't know this too. They didn't know what to do with the rocks. Because now remember, if you know anything about altars, it couldn't be cut stone. It wasn't cut stone. It had to be natural stone to make any altar. That was one of the rules of the deal. Because cut stone man had his fingerprint on it. Uh-huh. So that's what they thought. So they carried these rocks out of the temple, these stones that made up the deal, but they didn't know what to do with them. Now, what do we do with them? These, they considered them sacred. So what do we do with them? So they went up on the hill somewhere and stacked them up and brought in new stones. And to this day, no one knows exactly what happened to those stones. They said, we'll wait later till someone tells us how we should dispose of these stones. And no, as far as we know, no one ever did. And did you realize that just like the Lost Ark, and there's people who are searching for those stones today?
I had no idea.
Now see, a little bit of stuff there that you didn't know. But they just said, we don't know what to do. There's nothing tells us, there's no rules about what to do with something that's been desecrated in the temple. So they took it out and they wouldn't destroy them.
Sure, because that would be wrong too.
But it had the pig's blood all over them. Right. So they stacked them up on a hill there somewhere outside Jerusalem or around Jerusalem.
So
or
theoretically,
outside
somewhere there's still
those stones are still stacked somewhere with the blood of pigs on them that came out of the temple.
Huh.
Wow. Okay, is it me?
It's you.
We'll restrain our conclusion to just these words. We're thankful for this age of free exchange of information that enables us to explore, research, learn, and be liberated by and share our ideas and discoveries to any who wish to listen. And hopefully, this guarantees there will never be another period of history that might be referred to as the silent period.
Yes,
right. As always, may God's grace, peace, and love be on, in, and radiate out from each of you, our fellow seekers. From all of us here at God Beyond the Bible.
Did you enjoy listening to God Beyond the Bible? Do you have an idea for an episode? Connect with us today. Visit our website at godbeyondthebible.com, all one word, or send us an email at email@godbeyondthebible.com, or you can visit us on Facebook. Just type God Beyond the Bible into the search bar.